This podcast is supported by Siemens, your partner for industrial-grade AI.
Hey, it's me, Robert. Before we get into the main part with Peter, we need to talk briefly about the prices. I have Professor Dr. Günther Klambauer from the JKU Linz on the line. Hello, Günther. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Robert. Thanks for inviting me. Crazy times.
Yes. Crazy times. Two prices for AI. Does that make you feel euphoric? Are we at the peak of AI?
It seems so. Yeah. Yesterday, I had quite mixed feelings, actually.
And why?
Yeah. It's very strange for me that the Physics Nobel Prize went to Hinton and John Hopfield. So yeah, that was very surprising and still confusing. But today the Chemistry Nobel Prize for AlphaFold and David Baker with computational protein design, that's really cool and I think also well-deserved. Yeah.
So let's talk about Hopfield. Hopfield is All You Need was a title of one of your papers, right?
Yes, in 2020, yes. We had a paper titled Hopfield Networks is All You Need. Yes.
And so what is so special?
Yes, so back then in the early 80s, these were thought as storing devices. So they called associative memories. Mm-hmm. These are I don't know if he imagined it as software pieces or rather as hardware pieces. And they were already recurrent neural networks, what we call them. And at that point of time, quite a strange idea, I think. And nowadays, I mean, we have completely different deep neural networks, and these are behind the AI systems, as you said, behind ChatGPT and so on, but they're quite far from what he proposed back then. Yeah.
And I think MLSTM also uses Hopfield, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a vague connection exactly in the paper that you asked me. Yep. Hopfield networks is all you need. We basically made a connection between the large language models that we have now and these old Hopfield networks. And for them, so for that, we developed something that is called a modern Hopfield network, because those classic Hopfield networks were binary. So you just use binary data. Now it's continuous real world data and so on. So, but there is a slight connection that nobody was aware of. So unknowingly, the guys that built the transformers, the guys that built the large language model, they unknowingly used the kind of modern type of Hopfield networks, and we made this connection explicit. And now you could see that connection now with that. But yeah, these are, you could see as independent developments that later were connected by us. Yes.
But the architectures or the neural networks they established are no longer used today, right? Or am I wrong?
Yeah, no, you're right. They're no longer. So both the classic Hopfield networks, as they were in the 80s, and also the Boltzmann machines are not used anymore. In the 80s, I mean, they shaped a bit. They were recurrent neural networks, and back then, they shaped a bit this field, and there was a field about artificial neural networks that was shaped in the 80s already, mm-hmm. and then developed further in the 90s, for example, prominently by Professor Hochreiter and Professor Schmidhuber. And then
they are also mentioned in the paper.
Exactly. It also stated that this were the basis or the Nobel Prize led later also to something like the LSTM networks and so on, indeed. And then deep learning as we have it now was basically then further development of neural networks that started around 2005, 2010-ish. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Hinton is also viewed a little bit critically, right? Or am I wrong?
No. So I think he's perceived very critically. He has made a lot of exciting contributions to machine learning. How much contributions he made to physics is questionable. But yes, also the modern deep learning area. I mean, he was one of the famous authors of the ImageNet paper. So in 2012, this convolutional neural network that won the ImageNet challenge. He was one of the authors together with Ilya Sutskever and Alex Krzyzewski. And yeah, therefore, he's also a very prominent figure in this deep learning. And clearly, he's a personality in deep learning and machine learning as we have it now. But yeah, as I said, not so much probably in physics, but the physics people should decide on that.
Yeah. Let's talk about your domain, life science, chemistry. That was not surprising, was it?
No, I think a lot. I've seen it coming before, and AlphaFold has already obtained a lot of prizes. So it was Method of the Year, I believe, in 2021. Mm-hmm. So Nature has elected it. Not Nature, the Science magazine elects a scientific breakthrough of the year, and this was 2012. It was AlphaFold and so on, and then also this year, AlphaFold 3 was published in Nature. So these were the big things, and it completely changed molecular biology. So molecular biologists now, they have relatively easy access to protein sequences, and they regularly use AlphaFold to then predict how these proteins would look in 3D. So it had a tremendous impact there. And yeah, I think it's great that it's already got the Chemistry Nobel Prize now. Yeah.
Will we see more AI prizes in the next years? Or are the domains merging too much, maybe?
Yeah, I think we'll probably see more Nobel Prizes for AI, although maybe we have to wait a couple of years.
Yes.
And these are the big things. Like AlphaFold was one of the big things. And I don't know in which category other things would fall. It's a bit, so the Nobel Prize categories are not very up to current research and science, right? There are fields like molecular biology, computer science that didn't exist when the Nobel Prizes started. So we still have the classic categories of physics, chemistry, medicine. And therefore, it's also...
Literature is also a topic, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Literature.
Maybe Sam Altman has some opportunities for that.
Oh, no. Yeah. ChatGPT winning the Nobel Prize in literature, that would be a downer. Yes. No,
but will only AI help us to cross scientific boundaries in the future? So it will become a tool for scientists.
I think yes, and definitely, and that's already, we see it now. Scientists in all scientific areas use AI as a tool, and AI helps them. Deep learning, I want to mention explicitly, mm-hmm. Deep learning based AIs, they help researchers in all domains, be it molecular biology, medicine, all types of like weather simulations and so on, or climate research, whatever you name it, all of them are picking up AI techniques, and a lot of things will be possible with AI that were not possible before. So there's in most of the scientific domains, there's a big revolution going on. Yeah.
So are we at peak AI?
Can it peak more? I think we are at the peak now with 1 year, two Nobel Prizes, yep. And we will not see that probably for quite a time. So yeah, you could see it as a peak of AI now, yes.
Günther, thank you very much and all the best for you and your team.
Oh, that was a fast one. Thanks, Robert, for the interview. Great.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi there. Welcome to a new episode of the Industrial AI Podcast. My name is Peter Sieberg and I'm your host. Today, we'll be talking to Tom Cadera. He's the Managing Director, Cadera Design, and Marco Huber. Marco was with us before. He's professor at the University of Stuttgart, but I believe that today he is more as the representative scientific director, digitalization and artificial intelligence at the Fraunhofer IPA. And today's topic is going to be UA design and XAI for explainable AI. Hello, Marco.
Hello, Peter. Nice having me again.
You're welcome. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Marco.
So, Marco, let's start with you. Yeah, one or the other listener will recall that you have been with us before. Nevertheless, please let us know who you are and what you do.
Yes, sure. So, as you said, I'm a professor at the University of Stuttgart. So, I'm actually with the mechanical engineering department, but from a background, I'm a computer scientist. And I'm working in this interface between AI and manufacturing. So my core topic is to bring machine learning, artificial intelligence into the production processes. And at the same time, I'm also with the Fraunhofer IPA, which is the Fraunhofer Institute for Manufacturing Engineering and Automation. And there I'm a scientific director responsible for the topics of digitalization and artificial intelligence. Also there, we are looking into manufacturing processes and how they can be advanced and improved by using digitalization and machine learning technologies. And one of my core research topics is also the topic of today, which is explainability. So explainability of artificial intelligence, where we would like to increase the interpretability of machine learning solutions.
Very good. That's what we're going to be talking about later on. So, Tom, same thing for you. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you. I'm the founder and one of the two managing directors of Cadere Design. I studied industrial design a long time ago. And when you work as an industrial designer, you learn a lot about ergonomics. Based on this approach of making products fit for use, I started thinking in terms of usability early in my professional career. To me, usability is the logical continuation of ergonomics in product design. And as a result, we have been offering user interface design services as part of our portfolio since 1992 already. I think we were one of the first design offices who did that. And maybe we were, no, I'm quite sure we were pioneers these days. And maybe we are still now pioneers with the XAI thing. At Cadere Design, we have specialized in designing products and software for the industry. Our UX projects are tailored to the specific needs of industry, which is why I call them industrial-grade UX. Customers of ours are, for example, Siemens, Ullmann, SICK, ASA, Andersen Hauser, and the Volkswagen Audi product lines, or the production line, I should say.
Very good. So sounds like both of you are very well prepared and capable for the combined today's topic of UI design and XAI. So Marco, let's start with you. You are the co-author of a paper called How Should AI Decisions Be Explained? Subtitled Requirements for Explanations from the Perspective of European Law. But as I said, start with you. No, I want to actually start with you, Tom, because you read this paper, you made the community aware, and you publicly shared the question. You said, could XAI, so explainable AI, soon become mandatory for mechanical engineers, automation companies, and component suppliers? So Tom, please give us a first introduction into why this paper made you ask this question.
Well, I'm not a legal expert, but indeed, due to Marco's paper, that's obviously a fact. It seems to be quite clear that it becomes mandatory. But as I said, I'm not a legal expert. And if you ask me when all this or will be legally effective, it seems a little bit more complicated. Maybe, Marco, you can help when it will start to be mandatory.
I'm also not a legal expert, but I'm a bit aware of the AI Act. You might know that that's the big European regulation on artificial intelligence, which became active just recently in August. And when you look into this very large document, you will see here and there requirements or requests for stuff like transparency, interpretability, traceability, explainability. So especially explainability is mentioned several times in document, not too often, but it's mentioned. So you will find statements like that the output of an AI system needs to be explainable. And then, of course, you could raise the question, what does it actually mean? So what is explainable? And unfortunately, it's not defined precisely in this document, in this AI Act. But it becomes obvious that some degree of explainability will become mandatory, especially when we talk about high-risk AI systems.
So may I assume that maybe that was one of the reasons, one of the triggers, I would say, Marco, that you, together with a number of co-authors, wrote your paper. Who are those co-authors? Who is the paper written for? And was that the purpose? Was another purpose? And maybe you can share some very first conclusions.
Yeah, sure, of course. So this paper has a nice background. So one of the co-authors is Elena Dubovitskaya. She's a professor of law at the University of Gießen. And some time ago, it was in the beginning of 2023, she wrote a paper together with a co-author from the University of Tübingen about explainability and a specific aspect of law. It was about company liability. And two authors came to the conclusion that you have to apply in certain legal cases explainability methods. And then she approached me because somehow she got aware that we are doing research in this area, in XAI. And we came to the conclusion that we should address also other aspects of law. And so together with Benjamin Fresch and Danilo Brajovic, who are both in my team, and with Christian Hort, who is another lawyer, we started this endeavor. And what we actually did was to look in different law categories. For instance, in product liability was one aspect we looked into, also in the GDPR, so which is the data protection law, and others. And at the same time, we also came up with a set up of requirements of explainability. And then we made a cross check between what is requested in the law and what are specific requirements on XAI and how do they match. And one of the key outcomes of the paper is that there's a big gap. You have certain requirements in the law, often not very specific, because there's nowhere in current law, let's say in the old school law, it is clearly written that there should be explainability for AI systems, because okay, AI is a rather new topic. But you can derive certain requirements and then cross-check it, what is currently technically feasible, and there's a huge gap in between. So in ideal situations, if there would be a full-fledged XAI, it would be very helpful, but we are not there yet. And one of the key outcomes of the paper is to, let's say, give some hints to the XAI community to further develop the XAI methods in certain directions in order to fulfill the requirements of certain law.
Okay, so to eventually close that gap, I assume, and I'm sure that's what we're going to be talking about today. So Tom, you like the fact that, quote unquote, that the paper provides concrete XAI suggestions. You arrive at a specific conclusion. Maybe there's a couple of conclusions. Do you want to share them with us?
Yes, I'd like to. First, I see interactiveness. The paper says it's required to have interactiveness with the system. And it says you have to provide that also lay people have to understand what they are doing, what they see on their HMIs. And we have to pick them up in a mental way in their context and in their level of knowledge. That's the conclusion. And we find many aspects of classical criteria for usability. And what I also like very much was that they say include user interface designers in the process. That's what we always say. And you can really find things that should be done if you read that. My concrete conclusions are, of course, create more trust, provide transparency. And people have to understand, they want to understand. So we have to bring content to the user interface that provides understanding and explanations in order to create this trust and transparency. In practice, this means we have to make offers that let people decide how much detail they want to go, for example. Let them decide how deep they want to dive in. Details on demand, for example, is one of the usability principles that we need here. And what we also worked out is that probably we need to have an own color for AI things. Give AI an own color. That's a thing that others also claim. And what, for example, Volkswagen and Daimler do already with their AI systems. And maybe the most important thing is such a project also starts with user research. It should start with user research. And what we see outside is often that it's just only technology driven, what people do within AI projects. And we say, no, we have to involve the users from the beginning. We have to find out what they need and what they want, and especially what they understand.
maybe can hook in there. That's very important what Tom is saying here. It's not only from, let's say, the design of an AI system itself, that it's mainly technology driven, as Tom said. It's the same holds actually also for the methods to provide explainability. So the vast majority of techniques, methods, and papers are written for machine learning experts. But at the end, the user of an AI system, and so also the recipient of an explanation, is a layperson. And it's very important, as Tom said, to think about who will be the end user and design the explanations and how the explanations are delivered to the needs of this user group. So that's a core aspect which is often overlooked.
Very good. You confirming. So does it sound for you, then, Margaret, that Tom got the gist of your paper, or was he very selective, so to say, being a user interface guy? Is there just one or the other specific structural additional element you want to share with regards to the paper?
So he's actually correct. So UI, so user interface design, is an important aspect, even though it's not the core of the paper. Of course, we had the focus on the legal requirements. But one of our conclusions is that if you design an XAI system, you have to take the user interface into consideration, because somehow you have to deliver the explanation, especially most of the consumers probably are laypersons. And so the design of the user interface and also social aspects, that's another conclusion we came about, that you should also involve social sciences, for instance, in order to examine how effective are certain explanations. So do they really provide the value that is intended?
Right. So, Marco, the paper contains a tabular summary of the derived requirements, explanation, recommendations as a guidance for working with AI. Maybe you can, we're not going to go into any of them, but maybe you can share one or two examples with us.
Sure, I can do so. So what we did, as I mentioned earlier, we first started with designing some properties that an XAI system should satisfy. The vast majority of these properties we take from a paper which was written roughly 2 years ago by Maike Nauta and colleagues. And she and her colleagues define so-called 12 co-criteria. Co-criteria means 12, properties which all start with the letters CO, like correctness, completeness, and many four. And then we extended these co-criteria by another 5 co-criteria. So at the end, we end up with 17 co-criteria. And based on these criteria, we cross-checked with different law fields. And as I mentioned, one, maybe that's the one that is most familiar to many people, is the GDPR, so which is the data protection law. And here we take the perspective of a layperson. As I said, the user is very important. So if we assume that the audience of an explanation is a lay user, which of the properties are relevant for the GDPR? And then we came to the conclusion, of course, not all of them are required, which is, as I said, technically often not feasible, but some are really necessary. And one that is obviously necessary is correctness. Of course, the explanation that is provided should be correct. So it should coincide with the intent of the AI system. Otherwise, an explanation is just useless. I think that this somehow makes sense. But for instance, there's oftentimes a conflict between two other criteria. One is called completeness, which means the explanation should be as complete as possible. So provide all the aspects necessary to understand the outcome of an AI system. But on the other hand, it should be also compact. So it should be not too large, so to say. And these, of course, are two conflicting criteria. And oftentimes you cannot satisfy both of them simultaneously to a full degree. And you need to come up with a compromise. And oftentimes, especially when the end user is a layperson, it is more desirable to have a compact explanation, because a too large explanation becomes a black box again. And then it's not useless or just not used by the end user. And then the explanation is just worthless. These kind of criteria we checked also with other law fields.
And by the way, if I may add, this is one of the classical challenges we have in user interface design, to find a good way between completeness and compact
under compact saturation, of course. Yeah, that's typical for the user interface issue.
So, Tom, you initiated an exchange with the UI user interface design community regarding approaches that have seemed to work well. Did you get an answer? Did you maybe get a discussion going there?
And not so much reaction, not so much feedback yet. And surprising for me, but there was not much feedback. I had some calls with colleagues, and I found out that they think quite similar when they say, oh, that cannot be the solution to do all the things with prompting, for example, to pick out one of the questions we have. I believe it cannot be that we go back to a time when we had to enter the command line via MS-DOS. From a usability point of view, this simply requires too much implicit and hidden knowledge. And we have to provide additional controls, something visible, to help people to enter the desired information into the system and to get out what they want intuitively. So that's one of the things that others think as well, but I'm still waiting for more feedback, and I'm really looking forward to hear colleagues what they have.
Maybe we should set up something. Huh? If maybe it makes sense to have some kind of a workshop or a conference on that, so that let's say experts from different fields, like UI experts, UX experts, people from the XAI community, and maybe also from social sciences and also from the law perspective, because all these things come together and are to a certain degree necessary to provide and to design a useful XAI system for especially high-risk AI solutions.
Good idea. Brilliant idea.
Yeah, let's see if we get something going. As I mean, you both attend our AI, industrial AI podcast conferences. I think it's a smart idea. I'll discuss with Robert if in the near future exactly the topic of today is going to be one of our themes. By the way, MS-DOS, what is that, Tom? I think it was an operating system 50 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. But when we started our business, we found many user interfaces built on the MS-DOS basis. And that's where you had to just put in command lines instead of choosing something you have been offered.
Just for the younger listeners, that they know what we're talking about. So, Marco, which are the legal requirements related to XAI? I think you referred to GDPR ones, maybe the AI Act. Other ones, or what are the considered laws that apply?
Of course, we weren't able to cover all the specific laws. Such a paper has some limitations. So, for instance, I took the GDPR because it's very explicit on that. There are some articles in this law which are oftentimes described as the right to explanation. That's one of the very rare cases where it becomes very explicit. In other law fields, it's rather implicit. For instance, what we started with in the paper was these fiduciary considerations. So if you are a CEO of a company or a managing director, and you use an AI system as a decision support system, we came to the conclusion, especially it was the idea, also the finding by Elena, that here the so-called Ezion rules apply. So Ezion was a company in the dot-com area. So around the 2000s, one of the companies which also got bankrupt at this point in time. And there was a federal Supreme Court decision on this company. And from this decision, there is a set of rules, three rules, which are now called the Ezion rules by these companies. And it makes some requirements about an expert consulted by, for instance, a managing director. And these rules simply can be summarized like, the first rule is, if you consult an expert, it needs to be a qualified expert, somehow obvious, but this expert needs to have the qualification in the field you request support. Then the second law says this expert needs to be independent, so from a third party. And the third one is, as the recipient of this expert judgment, the, for instance, managing director has to do a plausibility check. And especially this third requirement, the plausibility check, from there we derived certain requirements for XAI. Because if you now use an AI system as a decision support system, you need to plausibility check the outcome of this AI system. And you only can do so, of course, if you get a certain understanding what the outcome, the output of the AI system is. And therefore, you need explainability. From there, we again apply this 12 co-criteria or now 17 co-criteria to derive which is necessary and maybe which properties can be neglected in this specific field of law.
Now, is this a typical Europe thing again that we're talking, you know, listeners from outside of the European Union that still stay with us because they're very interested in others? Maybe, oh, that's another typical Europe and law. And over the weekend, I think it was last Monday, so when we're airing this, it's probably a week ago, the governor of California voted against. You talk about a Brussels effect. Can you just say one, two things about, you know, what we're discussing here? Is it, you know, Europe, Germany, GDPR only, or does it work on a bigger global level?
So, for instance, these ESION rules I just mentioned, you can find similar rules, for instance, in the Delaware General Corporation Law, so which applies, of course, in the US. And here you have very similar statements like the expert needs to be chosen with reasonable care, and that the expert judgment needs to be plausibility checked. So it's not a singular European thingy, especially in this field of law. But of course, the AI Act is currently very specific European. Maybe others will follow. Let's see. As you mentioned, in California, they are currently not doing so. But this may be will change in the near future.
Okay. And so I would also assume and believe that what we're discussing today, you know, the use of UI design for closing the gap that was brought forward is going to apply, I'm convinced, on a global level. Although the laws may be different, but typically going in similar directions, more or less. So, Tom, are you and the UI designer community, you just refer to, at least maybe there's no public discussion, so maybe we're going to, you know, start that off after the podcast and or then, you know, taking care of the theme in one of our Industry AI podcast conferences. So are you and your colleagues, are you aware of those laws? I mean, do you keep yourself informed? Do you need to? Because maybe, it's the other question, maybe are the legal requirements, are they included in the requirements that you get from your customer? So is it in the end your customer who's going to be responsible or you as the UI design person?
First of all, I think the design community is not so much aware of the situation or all the legal issues. They're not quite interested in those things. And that's the thing, that's the point where we are. And it's quite right. We have to talk about it and we have to make it clear that there's a difference. And it's a big chance for our community, actually, of course, because that's really what we have to do anyway. We have to make it explainable anyway, and we have to do it a little bit more intensive, I guess, and in certain places. So that's quite normal for us, but it should be fitting to the new legal situation as well. And our customers are responsible for these legal things because they have the legal departments and they are liable, of course, when something goes wrong. So it's up to them to make it.
You have to make it work such that in the end it's going to confirm legally. Right. But nevertheless, if you're a customer, yes, I understand. And we'll talk about it in one, two examples at the end. But if your customer understands that you have at least a base understanding or maybe a very detailed understanding of the capability of user interface design to apply, to take care of specific legal requirements, they're going to be very happy with you making them aware of certain things, right? Rather than they need to tell you exactly how to do
it. Right.
So let's talk about who the different people are maybe related, the different, let's say, target audiences. So Marco, you use what you call a stakeholder-based approach for formulating legal requirements in your paper for the explainability of decisions made by machine learning based applications. And depending on the situation, you identify four groups. Can you share with us which they are?
Yes, as I said, we identified four. Could be more, but for the sake of the paper, we identified these four user groups. So one I already mentioned, this is the decision makers in companies, like a managing director, CEO, or board of directors, something like that. Then there's a second user group we also spoke about already, which are, let's say, the laypersons. We use this layperson particularly for the GDPR, for the data protection aspect. And then we have the developers of AI systems or of products which contain AI systems. And at the end, we have the operators. So those which are running using a machine learning AI system in their operations in the products. So these are the four user groups we considered.
So Tom, may I assume that maybe only the latter one, so the operator, the typical, let's say, target user for you, or are there any other ones for you as well?
There are other ones as well, of course, because we also have to provide good user interfaces for those people who do the ramp up and the service people. And we also have people who write the programs in order to run the machine. So we have different target groups anyway. And I think we have the challenge to do it different for every target group, as Marco already said. And yeah, the operator target group is maybe one of the most important ones because they run the machine. They work on the machine most of the time. So it's really an important target group for us, but not the only one.
Well, I could imagine that you work with different personas there. Maybe you say, you know, there's the young person just coming from, you know, having studied, it could be university, another kind of introductory course on machine learning, whatever it is. Maybe typically the young person doesn't have to be in another situation. It could be the person who has been doing something completely different, but who are new to the situation, let's say, as opposed to the person who's been working in a very similar environment for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. So I could imagine that maybe you differentiate between those different categories of operators.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, rather than going further in further detail of the paper, we'll most certainly make the link available in the podcast notes for those of you that do want to read it. But I suggest that maybe we look at one, two concrete examples on how to deal with those examples, those use cases, let's call them, from the perspective of XAI legal UI design perspective. So if I may, I suggest one, and then maybe, you know, both of you can suggest another if we want to. So why don't we look at a shop floor example? Let's say there's a blue-collar worker in front of a machine, we can all imagine, and that person makes a decision, changes a setting on the HMI, on the human-machine interface, which is based on the recommendation of the embedded machine learning model, you know, and that was received, again, typically, I guess, on the HMI. But, you know, let's assume the person, the blue-collar worker, is today or very soon, you know, interacting with the HMI in any kind of way. It could be voice or typing or whatever we can imagine. Now, resulting in, and let's say there's two possibilities, you know, number one possibility, in the end, what the product that's going to come out, the end customer is going to be so happy with, so it's always so perfect that they're going to choose the manufacturer of the blue collar worker as their preferred supplier. You know, everybody's happy. Number two could also be that it's going to go the complete other way. You know, it turns out that exactly this machine learning recommendation was the reason for a structural failure of the end user machine resulting in an accident. So whatever this decision is going to be that the person is making based on the machine learning is going to be, you know, very positive or very negative. So Marco, what are the XAI legal requirements that we're talking about? And Tom, just for you to prepare then afterwards, you know, how to deal with them from a UI design perspective. So, but first, let's start with Marco.
Well, this example is actually not that easy to handle. One could think about it has something to do maybe with product liability, but usually product liability only applies in products in private use. But in this scenario, as you outlined, this is a professional use. But sometimes these requirements in product liability are also to a certain degree applied to professional use. And of course, in addition, what is usually also considered is what is written in the BGB, so Bürgerliches Gesetzbuch, I think, which can be translated in civil law book of Germany. Here, the paragraph 823 is usually applied. But I think most important is what is stated in the terms and conditions, so in the contract between the machine supplier and, of course, the operator of the machine. That is usually the foundation when it comes to defect issues, liability issues. But let's assume it would be product liability just for the sake of the example. Then therefore we derived some requirements for an XAI system and we have not addressed them. Interestingly, we came to the conclusion that in this situation, the least properties apply. Of course, it should be also correct that it's always a necessary requirement. But for instance, we came to the conclusion that completeness is not a requirement in this situation, because it's just, as you mentioned, the operator of the machine, the blue-collar worker, needs a certain degree to trust the system, and therefore it's not necessary to have an overly complex, complete explanation. So here we have rather a focus on a certain degree of compactness, but not on completeness. And this is something maybe also that Tom would support, is what we call controllability, which maybe in the UX community is more defined as you should be able to interact with the system. And this we have seen as a requirement in this situation.
Controllability is one of the important criteria for usability, besides self-descriptiveness, task appropriateness, and something like that. And you mentioned already also the completeness. I think that's one of the most important things. In our study, we find out that we have to provide really details on demand because we don't know which person is sitting or standing before in front of the system and how much this person knows about the procedure, about the process, about the settings, whatever. So we have to offer a lot and we have to decide to let the people decide how deep they want to dive into the information we provide. And I think that's a new thing. We have to provide more and more and more details. And it's up to the persons and to their education level how deep they will dive into these information.
Maybe what I can add in this specific situation, we also came to the conclusion that the XAI system applied should provide what is called global explanations. So you can very coarsely discriminate XAI methods in two groups. One is called local explanations. These explanations just explain the very specific situation, and the global explanations try to explain the entire ML system. Ideally, it would be that you always could provide a global explanation, but oftentimes it's just not possible. And oftentimes these explanations are too complex, are too complicated. And this hooks to what Tom said. It makes then sense, depending on the user needs and the experience, that the user by himself or herself can decide how deep they would like to dig into the explanation to get an understanding. In the situation you mentioned with the blue collar worker, this is something that become more and more applied in near future. We currently have a lot of projects which are in the direction of how to support the worker in setting up the machine parameters in order to optimize the production process. And oftentimes now you have the situation that the person in front is not, let's say, the super experienced guy working since 30 years in the companies and know all the details of the machines. You often now have people which are not that familiar with the process. And there the explanation becomes even more important so that the user gets an understanding why certain recommendations by the AI system have a certain effect on the manufacturing process.
Okay, yeah, sure. The what is the responsibility of, in this case, the blue-collar worker? So is it more local than global, I guess? And that relates very strongly, I would say, to what you suggest as well, Tom. Maybe you start with an overview and you provide the option for the people to go to deep digger if they need to. So is there maybe, okay, so that was one example here. Is there another one that one of you, both of you want to discuss from both the, let's say, more legal and from the UI design perspective?
Maybe in a similar setup, let's assume that the AI system again is applied in the shop floor, but now has is responsibility for safety functions. Like could imagine a camera system that is safeguarding in a specific area of the production machine. And when a human worker is entering a certain location, then the machine should stop in order to prevent harm to the person. And then you could imagine, of course, that the camera images are processed by an AI system, like a deep convolutional neural network, something like that. And now it takes over safety function. Of course, it should work all the time. And now the machinery directive comes into play. This is still valid, especially the AI Act and the machinery directive are interacting with each other. So the one is not replacing the others. They both come into play. In this situation where it is a safety function, it is automatically a high-risk AI system. And the AI Act in this situation is then referring to the machinery directive. And from there, you can now derive certain requirements on the AI system that needs to be fulfilled. And of course, then also, even though it's not yet very explicit, on the explainability of this AI system.
Right. Does it make any difference for you, Tom, with regards to the UI design?
You mean the safety aspect?
Yeah, just in this different use case of the safety. Yeah.
The principles are the same. I think we have to be more detailed, maybe more clear, even because we have to deal with the health and of people. It must be maybe a little bit louder what we say means bigger or provided with more color, whatever. But the principles are clearly just the same.
I have a question to Tom. Let's assume something happens. For some reason, a person got injured. So, and now the question is, what happened, of course? Was it a failure of the person, of the AI system, because somehow it wasn't able to detect the person or something else? To get an understanding whose fault it is, what would be your perspective? How could explainability, maybe also user design, in order to help to get the root cause of this failure?
Yeah, I think that's not easy. But I'm just thinking about the situation where we have the process of getting medical equipment ready for the market. There we have to go through several regulations, and I can imagine that we will find something similar here in the machinery context if it comes to such things as health and safety. Just an idea. Can you imagine as well?
Yeah, I know from the medical perspective, that's actually a good idea that we can derive similar aspects also on the machinery. So interestingly, we will soon start a new project here at the Fraunhofer IPA where we look into especially also the machinery directive, so into safety of systems and when AI is used to take care of the safety functions. And we know currently it's not yet a fully solved issue what kind of information and what kind of requirements need to be derived for the AI system. So it would be interesting to look into certain use cases here and to see especially also how explainability could support either increasing the safety or when something happens, how to get quick understanding of the root cause of the issue.
Yeah, very interesting. it would be a pleasure for me to support you with your work in this case.
Very good. Yeah. I assume it's about the impact, right? If we're talking medical, let's say in a hospital as an example, or safety in a factory, it's about the impact, right? In either case of, you know, humans getting hurt or humans already being hurt, but being brought into an even worse situation. So getting to a close then, how do either of you see the user interface design change over the course of, let's say, the coming years? We just heard there is a number of projects coming up in this area with an ever-increasing involvement of industrial AI solutions. Now, let me play devil's advocate, not necessarily in the case of a hospital, but let's say in the case of production. Do autonomous lights out factories still need UI design?
Yes, of course. Maybe not for the operators and the so-called low-level operators in the production area, but of course you have always workplaces in different places, maybe for the production managers, for example, and they will have to deal with human-machine interfaces as well.
Even in light-out factories, there will be maintenance to be done. And I think for quite a while, this maintenance still will be done by humans, even though many people currently think about using humanoids. You have probably seen these trends of humanoid robots in the manufacturing domain. But I think for fine-grained, very dexterous tasks, which are often necessary in maintaining production machines, you can imagine that there is an AI system supporting, like a chatbot, something like a GPT system, which is used by the maintenance personnel to get a quick understanding what is wrong with the machine. And therefore, of course, explainability and also, more importantly, user interface design is a key issue.
Right. And of course, the playing devil's advocate with regards to the light-out factories was just one thought brought to the, not to the absurd, but, you know, even in 10 years from now, there's probably not going to be more than whatever, 1% of production facilities. So bring it back more down to how do you see then, more general, moving forward from where we are today? How long is it going to take? And what are the changes we're going to see with regards to UI design and the use, the ever-growing use of industrial AI solutions?
I strongly assume that there will be a personal assistant or agent on every HMI, whatever you want to call it, this concept, but it will be there. And I think that that helps people to do their work faster, easier, and safer. And I think that will be there in a few years already, maybe even faster, because we have such a high speed in this new AI technology.
Sure. Let me first say strong agreement on that one, but with another question to you. Could it be my personal assistant? Do you believe that we're going to have many, many, many different assistants around us? Or, and that is then my thought, but I'm interested in your view, I think we're all going to have our single one personal assistant. So if I am going to be the blue collar person, my view would be that my personal assistant is going to communicate with my opposite, so with the user interface design that you have designed for the machine. What do you think of that?
Yes, I think this is quite plausible. And I think there could be two ways of personal assistance, one for your private life and one for your work life.
Marco, any final close off thought that you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, maybe one thought. We oftentimes now see is the trend that, of course, the, let's say, the machine operator becomes also the trainer of the AI system. And I think here, again, the user interface plays a crucial role. Because now maybe a layperson who has never done anything or has no details about how machine learning works in all its details has now the responsibility to support the training of an AI system. And I think here the user interface design becomes even more important aspect, because the decisions then at the end made by the machine operator, like at this example we use as a training example, has a direct impact of the quality and the performance of the machine learning system.
Good approach. And I think it's crucial to have a good motivation for the people to do that, what we needed to bring the system in this better situation you described.
Yeah, that's a good point. At the end, the person needs some kind of an incentive. Why should I do this? And how does it support my work with the machine? That's a very important aspect.
Marco, Tom, thank you very much. It sounds to me like with this podcast, we could have potentially laid the groundwork for additional activities. One thought we had that maybe we're going to be taking this as a theme for one of our near future Industrial AI podcast conferences. Thank you very much. Listeners that want to get in touch with you can do so probably best by LinkedIn. We're going to put your names in the podcast notes. And otherwise, dear listener, if you have any question, comment, as always, please send a short email to peter@aipod.de. We are, of course, very happy that you stay with us so far. We hope that you learned something. Looking forward to have you with us again soon. Tom, Marco, thank you very much and bye-bye.
Thank you as well. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.